You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
And now we are beginning the reading of today's Boston Globe for this Monday, the 13th of April, 2026. With the Boston Globe reading, we say hello to Richard and Linda.
Thank you, John. From the front page of the Boston Globe, U.S. fires judge linked to Ozturk's case. Patel blocked Trump administration's bid to deport tough student. Others also dismissed. The article written by Julia McDonald and Nieto Del Rio from the Globe staff. The Trump administration has fired the immigration judge who terminated the government's deportation proceedings against Rumeysa Ozturk, the Tufts University graduate student who was arrested last year by ICE agents on a Somerville street. The judge, Rupal Patel, was based at the Boston Immigration Court and was nearing the end of her two-year probationary period when she received a notice Friday that she was being dismissed. She said in an interview with the Globe Sunday, "Even though I was expecting it, it was still sort of shocking," Patel said. "The consequences are immediate." Several other judges in Massachusetts and at immigration courts in other states were also fired in recent weeks, including the Chelmsford immigration judge, who earlier this year terminated the government's deportation proceedings against Columbia University student and Palestinian activist Mohsin Mahdawi. The dismissals were first reported by the New York Times. Immigration judges are employees of Executive Office for Immigration Review, the Department of Justice agency that runs the immigration courts. Under the executive branch, they can be summarily removed by the administration. The Immigration Review Office and the DOJ did not respond to a request for comment Sunday on why the judges were removed. But the Trump administration appears to be in the process of overhauling the immigration court system, including last week's dismissals. 113 immigration judges out of more than 700 have been fired since January 2025, according to Matt Biggs, president of the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. The union represents federal workers, including immigration judges. The terminations have happened without due process, cause, or explanation, Biggs said in a statement to the Globe. Immigration courts in Massachusetts have been hit particularly hard by the judicial firings. At the start of the Trump administration, there were 11 judges in Boston's immigration court. Now, only 5 judges are listed on its website. The courts in Boston and Chelmsford have been gutted. "This is wrong and unjust," Biggs said. In recent months, the administration has begun replacing the fired judges with its own appointees, some of whom have little expertise in immigration law. Patel said that she is not sure she was fired in retaliation for her ruling on the Ozturk case specifically, but that it appears the administration may be getting rid of judges who are not on board with its mass deportation agenda. "It's creating this climate of fear where judges are worried that if they misstep and do something that's out of line with that what the administration wants, they're most subject to firing," Patel said. "That can erode judicial independence, it can erode due process, and it can make people more likely to be ordered removed from this country." Patel ruled in January that the Department of Homeland Security had not met its burden to prove Ozturk's removability, according to documents that Ozturk's team submitted in federal court. Patel told the Globe that although she had been seeing reports about Ozturk's case on the news, this did not affect how she approached the case. "It was very important to me to treat her case with the same level of importance that I treat every other case," Patel said. "It is just about deciding the case in front of you fairly. The Department of Homeland Security is appealing Patel's decision in Ozturk's case to the Board of Immigration Appeals and Administration Court. Documents filed in the federal court show. Ozturk came to the attention of the federal government after writing an op-ed in the Tufts University newspaper that urged the school to listen to undergraduate students who had passed a set of pro-Palestinian resolutions. She was detained in March 2025 after the government silently revoked her visa and transferred her to a detention center in Louisiana, where she was held for 6 weeks. Her detainment, along with the arrest of other students, sparked indignation among civil rights activists, legal experts, and immigration advocates who contended that Ozturk was targeted for exercising her free speech rights. The Globe's reporting revealed that the government's own investigation found no evidence that she engaged in anti-Semitic activity or made any statements in support of a terrorist group. Still, the government is continuing to fight her cases in immigration court and in federal courts, alleging that she has been associated with activist groups on campus. In a statement to the Globe, DHS doubled down on its decision to appeal Patel's order to end Ozturk's deportation proceedings. This was more judicial activism at its core to keep a terrorist sympathizer in this country. We are under no obligation to admit them or let them stay here, a DHS spokesperson said on Sunday. The Trump administration has made it clear that anyone who thinks they can come to America and hide behind the First Amendment to advocate for anti-American and anti-Semitic violence and terrorism, think again. Immigration authorities arrested Madawi, a green card holder, in Vermont in April 2025, and he spent more than 2 weeks detained there. The judge in that case, Nina Froese, said Sunday she was not aware of who Madawi was when his case came before her and only found out later. I had never heard his name, Froese said. But like Patel, she said it wouldn't have mattered if she was familiar with Madawi. It's not a question of him or his politics. It's a question of the case before me, Froese said. The federal government has also appealed Froese's decision to the Board of Immigration Appeals, according to court documents submitted to Madawi's legal team. Froese said her dismissal has been a major disappointment, personally and professionally. I really enjoyed what I did. I always did the best that I could, Froese said. I'm definitely not happy about the outcome, but there's really nothing I can do about it at this point. Linda.
Thanks, Richard. Continuing on the front page, Tainted Wells, Tortuous Response. As residents await a fix ordered by state, health concerns increase, by Kate Selig in Westminster. In 2022, when this small town discovered hundreds of private wells had been contaminated with toxic forever chemicals, Massachusetts environmental officials were quick to identify the likely offenders and the fix. They ordered the local composting facility and the companies that sent their waste there to resolve the problem by connecting families to uncontaminated town water. But 4 years later, those companies have repeatedly blown past their cleanup deadlines, leaving Westminster residents to deal with the consequences. An unexplained rash on a child's skin, water that smells like sulfur and turns fabric orange, health conditions as severe as cancer that many here suspect were caused by the contaminated water. Today, many residents still rely on temporary stopgaps, bottled water or filtration systems that require regular maintenance. It's an increasing source of fear and frustration for residents who were promised permanent solutions by now. We know what the treatment is, said Ann Lutz, 62, a child psychiatrist who moved to Westminster with her husband in 2019. And they're not doing it while people are continuing to get sick. PFAS chemicals, known as forever chemicals because they build up in the body and persist in the environment, have been linked to an increased risk of developmental delays, certain cancers, and other harmful health effects. The concentrations in Westminster pose an imminent hazard. For residents of this rural 8,000-person town in the rolling hills of central Massachusetts, the pollution has turned their hidden gem into a nightmare. The toll extends beyond the hassle of managing bottled water deliveries, opening their doors for ongoing testing, and maintaining filtration systems. Many residents fear for their health and worry that past diagnoses may be linked to the contamination. Some feel guilty for not having tested their water sooner, while others long for the days when they could turn on the tap without a second thought. The contamination came to light in 2022 when a private well near the composting business, Massachusetts Natural Fertilizer Company, was found to have a concentration of 1,335 parts per trillion of six PFAS chemicals, more than 50 times the state limit for drinking water. Mass Natural's own well had a concentration of 5,720 parts per trillion, the highest ever recorded in Massachusetts. Environmental protection officials determined that Mass Natural and the owner of the land, Otter Farm, were likely to be blamed, as well as five companies that had sent waste: Seaman Paper, Grief, the Newark Group, Rust-Oleum, and Ball. The state ordered a cleanup. Forever chemicals have been discovered in more than 200 residential drinking water wells near the facility. Almost all these homes now have filters installed to address the contamination, and blue 5-gallon water bottles line many driveways. In addition to those temporary measures, the state ordered the companies to build a water line linking homes with contaminated wells to town water. But the companies missed the July 2024 deadline to submit a detailed waterline design, and they remain far behind in actually connecting homes. By December of 2025, they were supposed to have connected a neighborhood of about 60 homes to town water. As of now, just 15 homes have been connected. In March, state environmental officials ordered the companies to finish construction of the waterline extension for the neighborhood by the end of this year, warning of potential fines and legal action. Though the state has been working with the companies on a waterline for more than 3 years, the companies have not made significant progress, state officials said in a March 6th order. Mass Natural is fighting that mandate. A lawyer for the company told the Globe the water line is a, quote, complicated infrastructure project and was delayed by harsh winter conditions. The lawyer, George Haler, added that Mass Natural was not an active contributor to the contamination because it did not produce or manufacture PFAS. The other companies did not respond to requests for comment. The businesses that sent waste have previously disputed that they contributed to the pollution. Two of the seven companies, Ball and Rust-Oleum, have not joined the cleanup effort despite the state order. Meanwhile, residents are increasingly frustrated that the companies aren't working faster and that the state isn't being more forceful. They're dragging their feet, said Derek Brazilli, 54, who raised his two sons in Westminster. I don't understand why it hasn't been done yet, and now they've got an extension. While they wait, families are contending with imperfect temporary solutions and grappling with the knowledge that they likely drank contaminated water for many years. Some have filed a lawsuit seeking damages for medical monitoring expenses and diminished property values, among other costs. The problem is not only in Westminster. PFAS have been found in more than 170 public water systems in Massachusetts and many private wells at unsafe levels. Cleanup costs can run into the millions, expenses often shouldered by residents. As the Westminster example shows, even ordering companies to address the pollution doesn't always solve the problem. What we see in Westminster is the problem that many communities will have if we fail to tackle PFAS contamination, said Deidre Cummings of Mass PIRG, a nonprofit that has advocated for stricter regulations on forever chemicals. Lutz, the child psychiatrist, becomes emotional when she talks about the health problems she has seen in her community. She recently went door to door to make sure her neighbors had agreed to get their wells tested and was horrified by the reports she heard of residents coming down with cancer and other diseases. "I'm really concerned about the health of our community," Lutz said. Some homeowners said the interim solution, the water filtration systems, has brought their own challenges. Norma Avalar, 42, said her filtration system produces water with a sulfur smell that stains her white shower curtains. Her 4-year-old son Maddox developed raw red welts across his body that subsided when he bathed elsewhere. "You always wonder, is this connected?" she said of the health challenges. She's begun documenting the PFAS contamination on social media. The Westminster Board of Health ordered Mass Natural in February to test whether the filter systems meet town requirements. Mass Natural has insisted that the systems are not causing residents issues and is fighting the testing order. The delays have been especially frustrating for residents who were supposed to be connected to municipal water by now. Vinnie Miola, 52, moved to Westminster about a decade ago, seeking a quieter town with a better school system for his young son. Before he bought the house, he even tested the water quality, though the test did not check for PFAS. He thought he was making the right decision for his family. When Miola learned that his son was contaminated, he remembers feeling panic, not for himself, but for his son. His wife, a nurse practitioner, told him that the health effects could take years to appear. "I've always told my kid, own up to your mistakes and do the best you can to make good," he said. "The companies at fault," he said, "are not making good. They're trying to get out of this." Richard?
Thank you, Linda. This article from the World section of the Boston Globe. Orbán concedes defeat in Hungary's election. Results likely to disappoint Putin and Trump. Article written by Andrew Higgins and Lily Rutai in the New York Times. Budapest. Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary, a lodestar for megaculture warriors and right-wing populists in Europe, conceded defeat Sunday in a general election, breaking the momentum of a global nationalist revival promoted by President Trump. In a surprisingly early and gracious concession speech in Budapest, Orbán congratulated the opposition, saying, "The responsibility and opportunity to govern were not given to us." But he also made a vow, "We are not giving up, never, never, never." His defeat paves the way for Peter Magyar, a former Orbán loyalist and the leader of the main opposition party, to take over as Hungary's prime minister once the newly elected parliament meets. "We have done it," Magyar told a cheering crowd gathered with flags on the bank of the river Danube. "We have liberated Hungary and have taken back our country." Sunday's vote was widely seen as a showdown between friends and foes of liberal democracy, a cause that Orbán has battled against for years to applause from his fans in the United States, Europe, and Latin America. The race was closely watched by the Trump administration and the Kremlin, both of which wanted Orbán to win and both of which offered support in his campaign. The implications of the outcome extend far beyond Hungary's borders. The next prime minister may help alter the course of the war in Ukraine, a neighbor that Orbán has cast as an enemy of Hungary, and affect European security. And the results will be looked at by populists around the world who view the Hungarian leader as a model of success and of pugnacious defiance of a mainstream. After the results, large crowds of mostly young people thronged the banks of the River Danube in front of the parliament building, cheering and waving Hungarian flags. Many were stunned by the speed and scale of the defeat of Orbán, whose party won the 4 previous elections easily. With 66% of votes counted, Magyar's opposition party was on course to win 137 seats, more than a 2/3 majority. Orbán's party, Fidesz, was expected to win just 55. Shortly before polls closed, electoral authorities said that more than 77% of registered voters had cast ballots, the highest turnout in a Hungarian election since the collapse of communism in 1989 and the start of democracy. "Thank you, Hungary," Magyar said in a brief message on Facebook, reporting that Orbán had called to congratulate him. During his 16 years in power, Orbán remained Hungary in his own image, eliminating many checks and balances by stacking the judicial system and nominally independent agencies with Fidesz loyalists and taking control of most news media outlets. He also worked to export his model of illiberal democracy, promoting himself as an invincible guru for followers across Europe and elsewhere. Sunday's election results are likely to disappoint Trump, who sent Vice President J.D. Vance to Budapest, the Hungarian capital, last week to rally support for Orbán in the final stretch of the campaign. But Orbán's defeat will delight liberals and the European Union, which had increasingly come to view him as a disruptive menace. Before the results were known, Magyar noted that Election Day was the anniversary of a 2003 vote in favor of joining the European Union, a signal that he may move to end the Orbán government's antagonism toward the bloc. Long a thorn in the side of EU officials in Brussels, Orbán has consistently blocked European assistance to Ukraine, worked to water down sanctions on Russia, and presented Ukraine, not Russia, as the principal threat to Europe's security. Those positions made him an invaluable ally for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin, hoping to help Orbán's chances in the election, assured him last month that Hungary could rely on steady deliveries of Russian oil and gas despite disruptions to global energy supplies caused by the war in Iran. Despite his country's small size and population of fewer than 10 million people, Orbán, 62, has played an outsized role on the world stage. He became the standard bearer for right-wing politicians committed to family values against what he has denounced as degenerate multicultural liberals. While sharing some of Orbán's views on the importance of national sovereignty and the dangers of woke ideology, Magyar, a lawmaker in the European Parliament and divorced father of three, won votes for Tisza by promising drastic change, though he was often vague. On one issue, he has been unequivocal. Magyar, 45, promised voters a clean break with the endemic corruption that has enriched the Prime Minister's family and friends and helped saddle Hungary with the slowest growing economy in the region. Hungary, according to an annual ranking by Transparency International, is the most corrupt country in the European Union. Eager to reach beyond Budapest liberals, who have loathed Orbán for years, Magyar stayed far away from issues dear to progressives, such as LGBTQ rights. He campaigned mainly on his biggest asset. He is not Viktor Orbán. Linda.
Thanks, Richard. Back to the front page. Keneally pivots on issues he once oversaw. GOP hopeful had key roles in housing and energy policies. By Anjali Hoon. As the state's top economic development official, Mike Keneally once touted a tenet of the MBTA Communities Act as good housing policy. He warned that the state's shelter system needed more money to accommodate an influx of people coming into the system. And he was among those consulted on the state's efforts to shift away from fossil fuels and toward so-called clean heat. Mike Keneally, the candidate for governor, however, has struck a different tone. He's now a critic of some of the very issues he once tackled in state government. Keneally, who became the first GOP candidate to launch a run against Governor Mara Healey a year ago, is distancing himself from efforts he was previously involved in under former Governor Charlie Baker. Many of those issues have become punching bags within his own party and are animating the three-way Republican primary. That includes the MBTA Communities Act, a law signed by Baker requiring communities to change zoning to allow for more multifamily housing, for which Keneally shaped the regulations. Similarly, Keneally has joined other Republicans in blasting lawmakers and Healey for pouring billions of dollars into the emergency shelter in recent years, after himself previously recommending that it needed more funding. He's also become a fierce opponent of the state's embrace of clean energy policy after once publicly supporting the state's ambitious goals to reduce emissions as a member of Baker's cabinet. In an interview, Keneally acknowledged he dealt with those policies under Baker, but he said the Healey administration took what the Baker administration did on several issues too far, including forcing compliance from cities and towns on zoning policy. In other cases, Keneally argued Healey inadequately responded to crises the Baker administration warned about. As governor, Keneally said he would take a step back and let Massachusetts communities decide what they want on a case-by-case basis. His time with the Baker administration, he said, gives him, quote, relative to anybody in a race, a real knowledge and appreciation for the state and how we get things done around here. Tatish Netta, a University of Massachusetts Amherst political scientist, sees Keneally's pivot as an effort to emphasize his government experience built during 8 years under Baker, including 4 as economic and housing secretary, while distancing himself from the Democrat he's seeking to replace. I don't think people remember that the MBTA Communities Act originated during the Baker administration, and I'm definitely sure they don't remember that the shelter crisis had its origins in the Baker administration, she said. Keneally, he said, is leveraging that lack of understanding to present himself as the solution to the most pressing problem in the state. Keneally has styled himself in the vein of the governor he once served under, a pragmatic, policy-focused candidate not aligned with the Trump administration and National Republican Party, deeply unpopular in Massachusetts. Addressing housing was top of mind for Baker, who repeatedly pushed for legislation to lower the threshold local officials needed to rezone land for building certain housing. At the same time Baker was lobbying for that change, legislators advanced what became known as the MBTA Communities Act to encourage more multifamily housing and to combat the state's housing crisis. It's since spurred rounds of litigation and fierce resistance from some local officials in a handful of communities, with residents concerned about how building housing in historic districts and increasing density could change their communities. Lawmakers included both measures in an economic development bill Baker signed in 2021. Advocates and lawmakers who worked with Keneally told the Globe he was involved in conversations about the bill before it emerged from the legislature. He later spearheaded the creation of guidelines that the administration implemented after the law passed. The administration and Secretary Keneally were very active in the framing of this legislation, and then they took the next step of setting the regulations that we're all trying to abide by today, said former state senator Joseph Boncour, a Democrat who was on the legislators' housing committee. When the Baker administration put out its final guidelines in August of 2022, Keneally hailed the multifamily zoning requirement as setting the table for more transit-oriented housing in the years and decades ahead, which is not just good housing policy, but good climate and transportation policy, too. But since running for governor, Keneally has repeatedly criticized Healey and Attorney General Andrea Campbell's enforcement of those guidelines. In January, he accused state Democratic leaders of, quote, railroading municipalities while simultaneously underfunding them, and said Campbell had completely weaponized the act by suing cities and towns that have not complied with the law. Those words drew attacks from Keneally's primary opponents, namely Brian Shortsleeve, another Republican candidate for governor who headed the MBTA under Baker. Shortsleeve accused Keneally of having flip-flopped on the issue and, quote, acting like he had nothing to do with it. Keneally, in a Globe interview, said he did not see the guidelines the Baker administration implemented as enforcement. Campbell and Healy, he said, took a much more punitive approach than the guidelines he crafted, which are still in place under Healy, necessitated. If elected, Keneally said he would not direct cities and towns to adopt the law in a particular way, instead encouraging them to build housing without involving the courts. In our view, we made it so flexible that really anybody could adopt it any way they wanted. And if they were struggling with that, we had a ton of resources on our team to help them, he said. You've got to work with cities and towns that actually want housing. You've got to be a supportive partner, Keneally added. Once you're telling people what to do, you ruin that dialogue. Clark Ziegler, who headed the Massachusetts Housing Partnership for more than three decades, said the Baker administration engaged community stakeholders in an all-hands-on-deck within state government while drafting the guidelines. Lawsuits against communities that did not comply, in Ziegler's view, were destined to happen under the Baker administration's guidelines. It's not the only housing issue on which Keneally has changed his tone. In 2022, the final year of Baker's term, Keneally warned the emergency shelter system was becoming overwhelmed by an influx of families coming over the country's southern border. As secretary, he oversaw the opening of shelters and resource centers to accommodate families who needed housing under the state's Right to Shelter law, which has guaranteed temporary shelter to pregnant women and families with children since 1983. The alternative, Keneally said in a press release at the time, is making families sleep outdoors while we wait for a more permanent housing placement, which is unacceptable. Baker, that November, asked the legislature for an additional $130 million to fund the shelter system. Lawmakers didn't act on the request before Baker left office the next month. That crisis grew under Healy, with thousands of migrant families flooding the system and shelter costs rising to nearly $1 billion a year. Keneally has repeatedly pounced on the issue. Last October, as pressure eased on the system and the state stopped using hotels to house families, Keneally claimed Healy continues to fuel this crisis and criticized lawmakers for spending nearly $1 billion a year to house migrants while veterans sleep on the streets. When I'm governor, there will be real residency requirements, not loophole-laced policies that invite abuse, he said. Healy, in 2024, backed then-President Joe Biden's efforts to effectively close the country's southern border to asylum seekers after the country saw a massive influx of migrants during the first years of his presidency. Last year, Healy and the legislature reshaped the state's Right to Shelter law, including requiring homeless families to prove lawful immigration status. That change, among others, tightened the system to the point that shelters now serve less than half the number of families from a decade ago under Baker. If elected, Keneally said, he would further reform but not repeal the state's Right to Shelter law, and argued Healy should have advocated more strongly for a more secure border earlier on. At the time we left office, this was a very small problem. But it was not a trend, Keneally said, of the swell of migrant families coming to the state. They could have reformed the system and saved all that money. Carissa Hand, a spokesperson for Healy, contended her administration inherited a flawed shelter system under Secretary Keneally's direction from the onset, arguing it wasn't equipped to handle the swell of families that overwhelmed it. Similarly, Keneally has repeatedly attacked climate and energy goals shaped by the Baker administration. That includes the Clean Heat Standard, an effort to work towards Massachusetts emissions goals by requiring energy suppliers to use clean heat sources, such as electric heat pumps, instead of fossil fuels, a measure Keneally vowed to repeal if elected. Keneally, as the State House News Service reported, was one of several secretaries who appointed members to a commission that drafted the state's approach to reducing emissions in response to a 2021 law seeking to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Keneally says he added property developers who could articulate the repercussions that environmental mandates would have on solving the housing crisis. When the Baker administration put out a clean heat report in 2022, Keneally thanked the commission, saying that prioritizing energy-efficient practices across our building sector is key to growth. The Baker administration produced a report with recommendations that the Healey administration used to create Massachusetts' current standard. Healey this year delayed adopting the new clean heat standard until 2028, which her office framed as a bid to keep costs down. In January, however, Keneally called the clean heat standard a textbook example of government overreach that was crafted behind closed doors by climate activists. He argued that Massachusetts' goal to reach zero carbon emissions by 2050 drove up energy costs and said Massachusetts should invest in other energy sources, such as natural gas and nuclear energy. Massachusetts needs a serious, results-driven energy strategy, one that prioritizes lowering costs and ensuring reliability, Keneally said in a statement to the Globe. If elected, he said he would seek to repeal the state's goal to zero out its greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. I have been a strong and consistent advocate for sending the net zero by 2050 mandate, Keneally said. Richard?
Thank you, Linda. This from the World section of the Boston Globe. After talks fail, Trump threatens Strait blockade. A full closure will most likely keep gas prices high. Article written by Katie Rogers, Farnaz Fasisi, and Thomas Fuller from the New York Times. Hours after the United States failed to reach a deal to end the war in Iran, President Trump on Sunday sought to ratchet up pressure on Tehran, vowing to blockade the Strait of Hormuz, a critical waterway for Iran and the global economy. Effective immediately, the United States Navy, the finest in the world, will begin the process of blockading any and all ships trying to enter or leave the Strait of Hormuz, Trump said on social media Sunday morning. He added, any Iranian who fires at us or at peaceful vessels will be blown to hell. In threatening to close the strait, Trump appeared to be trying to strip Iran of the leverage the waterway has provided Tehran since the start of the war 6 weeks ago. Iran's selective closure of the strait prompted a surge in gasoline prices and inflation in the United States. A total blockade of the strait would most likely keep gasoline prices high and be perilous for countries in Asia that rely heavily on Persian Gulf energy supplies. It would also cut off crucial exports of fertilizer, helium, and be a further blow to Arab Gulf states. The president's threat came hours after Vice President J.D. Vance left a marathon session of peace talks in Islamabad without a breakthrough. Iran relies heavily on revenue from oil that it exports through the strait, and more recently, it has sought to collect tolls from ships using the waterway. We're not going to let Iran make money by selling oil to people that they like, Trump said in an interview Sunday with Fox News. Trump played down the economic effects of the war, which had been a political liability as U.S. midterm elections approach. Asked if oil and gas prices could fall by the time the elections are held in November, he said they could be the same or maybe a little bit higher, an indication that the economic turmoil of the war could linger for months, even if a lasting peace is reached. Data released last week showed inflation spiking in the United States in March because of energy costs. The price of regular gasoline jumped 25% from February to March, the highest monthly percentage increase on record, according to data from the Energy Information Center. During the course of the war, Trump has put forth numerous goals, including regime change in Iran and the degradation of the Iranian military. But in two lengthy social media messages Sunday, the president described Iran's nuclear program as the only point that really mattered in the weekend negotiations. Iran, he said, was unwilling to give up its nuclear program. The Strait of Hormuz emerged as perhaps the most potent bargaining chip for Iran during weeks of bombing by the United States and Israel. A two-week ceasefire began April 7th and ends April 21st. Iran's leaders have consistently given no indication that they intend to relax their control of the strait until a permanent peace is reached. In a defiant post on social media earlier Sunday, Ali Akbar Velayati, an advisor to Iran's supreme leader, said the key to the strait is firmly in our hands. Democrats, who have accused Trump of growing erratic in his decision-making in the war, were critical of the president's threat to close down the strait. I don't understand how blockading the strait is somehow going to push the Iranians into opening it, said Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. I don't see the connection there. Using blockades has been a preferred tool for Trump in his second term. He has implemented them in Cuba and Venezuela, frequently citing the latter as a model military intervention. On Saturday, 12 ships crossed the strait, according to data from Kpler, a global ship tracking company. It was the highest number of crossings in the strait since the ceasefire was announced, but a fraction of the traffic that used the waterway before the war. Two U.S. warships entered the strait Saturday and destroyed an Iranian surveillance drone approaching one of the warships, according to multiple U.S. officials. The negotiations in Pakistan over the weekend were the highest-level face-to-face encounter between U.S. and Iranian leaders since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Vance told reporters that Iran had chosen not to accept our terms. The chief Iranian negotiator, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, said on social media that the United States had been unable to gain the trust of the Iranian delegation in this round of talks. As Vance announced in Pakistan that no deal had been reached, Trump was in Miami watching the MMA fight. The president spent several hours at the UFC event, accompanied by Secretary of State Marco Rubio and members of his family. It was unclear whether the president knew that negotiations had failed by the time he entered the arena. For the most part, he sat impassively as blood and saliva sprayed out from the fighters, beating each other in front of him. Analysts said the issues in the peace talks were so complex and their differences so entrenched that cinching a deal in a single round of talks had been highly unlikely. Neither Trump nor Ghalibaf appeared to rule out additional negotiations, although no U.S. negotiators remained in Islamabad after Vance's departure. Trump told Fox News on Sunday that his threats had forced Iran to the bargaining table and they haven't left, adding that he believed the United States would eventually get everything it wanted from Iran. Linda.
In Washington, President Trump attacked Pope Leo XIV on social media on Sunday, saying the first American pope should, quote, stop catering to the radical left. It was an extraordinary broadside against the global leader of the Catholic Church, exacerbating a feud that began over the war in Iran. Pope Leo is weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy, the president wrote on social media. He also wrote that, quote, I don't want a pope who thinks it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. A short time later, speaking to reporters after Air Force One landed outside Washington from Florida, Trump said, we don't like a pope who says it's okay to have a nuclear weapon. He's a very liberal person, Trump said of Leo before adding, I'm not a fan of Pope Leo. Trump's post followed Leo, having denounced over the weekend the delusion of omnipotence that is fueling the U.S.-Israel war in Iran and demanded political leaders stop and negotiate peace. Leo presided over an evening prayer service in St. Peter's Basilica on the same day the United States and Iran began face-to-face negotiations in Pakistan during a fragile ceasefire. The U.S.-born Pope didn't mention the United States or Trump by name in his prayer, but Leo's tone and message appeared directed at Trump and U.S. officials, who have boasted of U.S. military superiority and justified the war in religious terms. Leo is scheduled to leave Monday for an 11-day trip to Africa. In Miami, Trump was at UFC fight while Iran talks collapsed. On Saturday evening, as Vice President J.D. Vance took a podium in Pakistan and said no deal had been reached to end the war in Iran, President Trump was in Miami watching an MMA fight. Trump spent several hours orbited by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a few of his children, some UFC officials, Sergio Gore, the U.S. ambassador to India, recording artist Vanilla Ice, Dan Bongino, the former deputy director of the FBI, and Manosphere shepherd Joe Rogan. He was surrounded by people, but Trump was somehow an isolated figure. People mostly circulated around him, checking in with updates and then leaving again. For the most part, Trump sat and impassively watched blood and saliva sprayed out from the fighters beating each other silly in front of him. It was unclear whether the president knew that negotiations had failed by the time he entered the arena for the UFC event to a Kid Rock song and thunderous applause. He wasn't tapping away on his phone. He left that to Rubio, who at one point leaned over to show the president his screen. And he didn't betray disappointment or anger. He offered tight smiles for the cameras instead and a thumbs up for the winners. In fact, on his way to Florida, Trump had told reporters that it did not matter to him if a deal with Iran was reached or not. We win regardless, he said. We've defeated them militarily, which sounded a lot like everything he had said before negotiations began. The political reality facing Trump is grim, just as the economic reality facing Americans appears to be getting worse. Inflation is rising. Gas prices are eating into American paychecks, a direct result of a war Trump ordered. The president has responded to the pressure by attacking his critics and threatening his adversaries. There was a widespread outcry from Democrats and some of his longtime supporters over his threat to wipe out the entire civilization of Iran. Democrats in Congress, alarmed by Trump's behavior, want to see him impeached. And they're questioning his mental fitness for office. They want to see his physician give Trump a complete cognitive exam, and then they want to interview the physician. All of that awaits Trump back in Washington. But on Saturday night, in his adopted home state, he spent his time in an arena where people treat him like one of the prize fighters when he walks into the room. After a week spent largely out of sight but lashing out at his enemies on social media, Trump's resurfacing at a match seemed designed to provide him with a soothing balm of male aggression, musky sweat, and cheering supporters, not unlike one of his political rallies. And from the New York Times, U.S. to deport son of Iranian Revolution spokesperson. The Trump administration arrested and said it would deport the son of an Iranian woman who gained fame as a spokesperson for the Iranian militants who stormed the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979. Federal agents arrested Syed Issa Hashimi, his wife, Marianne Tomasibi, and their son, who was not identified by name, after the United States this week revoked their permanent resident status, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced on Saturday. The three are now in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement pending deportation. A State Department statement on the matter did not accuse the three arrested of any specific unlawful or harmful acts, but stated that the Trump administration will never allow America to become a home for foreign nationals tied to anti-American terrorist regimes. Hashimi is the son of Masuma Ebtekar, who served as the English language spokesperson for the Islamist embassy captors during the 444-day hostage crisis. Hashimi had been the subject of recent reports in conservative media outlets that portrayed him as living comfortably in Los Angeles while working as a psychology professor. The State Department branded Ebtekar a propagandist who made false claims that the American hostages were treated well. Ebtekar evolved into an Iranian reformist politician holding senior government positions advocating for the environment and the rights of women, and served as Iran's vice president from 2013 to 2021. She has sought to move beyond her revolutionary past. In a 1998 interview with the New York Times, she asked a reporter not to focus on her role during the crisis. Richard?
Thank you, Linda. Several articles from the daily briefing section. 23-story hotel in exclusive Miami locale vanishes in seconds with implosion. Miami, a hotel at one of Miami's most exclusive locations, was demolished Sunday to make way for something bigger. Demolition experts completed the controlled implosion of the former Mandarin Oriental, Miami, on Brickell Key, a man-made island at the mouth of the Miami River, across from downtown. It marked the largest implosion for Miami in more than a decade, officials said. The 23-story building, which opened 25 years ago, collapsed in less than 20 seconds following blast that occurred around 8:30 a.m. People watching the implosion safely from afar cheered and recorded videos as the building's framework collapsed following a series of rapid charges. Dust soon filled the air as building material crashed down. Some watchers wore face masks as they left the area. Residents within 800 feet of the building were asked to stay inside their apartments during the blast with windows and doors closed. According to Swire Properties, the demolition will make way for the groundbreaking of the residences at Mandarin Oriental, Miami, a two-tower ultra-luxury hotel and residential development scheduled for completion in 2030. The operation follows nearly 2 years of planning and coordination with specialized contractors in the city, developers said. Implosion was selected as the safest and most efficient method to maintain the project timeline while minimizing disruption and ensuring the safety of the Brickell Key community. The implosion happened a couple of minutes after what looked and sounded like blue and pink tinted fireworks were set off near the top of the building. That article from the Associated Press. Next article also from the Associated Press. Police say one killed and six injured in shooting at a Chick-fil-A in New Jersey. Union, New Jersey. Police say one person was shot and killed and six others were injured in what they call a mass shooting at a Chick-fil-A in Union, New Jersey. Investigators do not believe the attack at about 9 p.m. Saturday was random, according to a press release issued Sunday from the Union County Prosecutor's Office. No arrests have been made, but the office said there is no immediate ongoing threat to the general public. The injuries are not believed to be life-threatening, the release said. A ride-hail driver told WABC that he heard more than seven shots from close range as he approached the restaurant. New Jersey Governor Mike Sherrill said Sunday on social media, "Our hearts go out to the victims' loved ones, and we are hoping for full recovery of those who were injured. She urged people with information to contact authorities investigating the shooting. The spokesperson for Chick-fil-A declined to comment, citing the ongoing investigation. The homicide task force at the county prosecutor's office is investigating. Well, that's about it for this morning. Thank you all for listening, and you have a wonderful day.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069 or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.